Hello and welcome to 42 Talks, the podcast which takes a deep dive into the legal world, led by the experienced members of 42BR Barristers. I'm Richard Little, a member of the family team at 42BR, and I'm delighted to be joined by Mark Challoner to discuss international adoption. Morning, Mark.
Good morning, Richard.
Right, well, the first thing perhaps to say about international adoption is it's incredibly complicated.
Yes, I mean, unfortunately, one of the things I would say at the outset about international adoption is every case is different. Every case has a specific set of factual circumstances. Every case will involve a different country and its own legal rules and indeed customs. I don't know how you feel about that, Richard, but certainly that's been my experience.
Yes. And the rules themselves, they're written in a complicated way, perhaps, with many references to other rules. It's all cross-referenced to other conventions and rules. Perhaps necessarily so, because it's important not to forget what's at stake here with international adoption. You've got transformative orders potentially being made, but also, as has been set out in a number of authorities, the risks to children potentially from international adoption are really quite serious. Sir James Mumby, former president of the Family Division in Northumberland County Council versus Zed, a 2009 case, said this: the vicious, the criminal, the depraved, and the merely desperate are adept at manipulating legal and border control procedures for their own purposes. So that's what's at stake, perhaps, with international adoption. It's some of the most serious experiences a child could have at the hands of the heinous and the wicked.
Indeed. And I think it's right to say at the outset, there is an ongoing policy debate internationally about international adoption, in fact, dealing with the UN Rights of the Child, Convention on the Rights of the Child, and the question of whether international adoption, which undoubtedly in some cases has real benefits to it, is also misused in some cases. But as I say, it does come down to individual cases and individual circumstances. Another interesting aspect I always think about international adoption, though, is that as a family lawyer, and I am absolutely a family lawyer, nothing else, it's fair to say, it does take you outside your comfort zone sometimes because you have to have the crossover with immigration law and things of that nature as well.
Yes, absolutely. Let's start off then with perhaps looking at what is an adoption, particularly in the context of international adoptions. Mark, Section 66 of the Adoption and Children Act 2002 is the place to begin, isn't it?
Yes. So obviously that, in essence, sets out four types of adoption. And I'm sure we'll move on to all four in due course. But there are, first of all, the adoptions we come across day in, day out. So adoptions made by an adoption order in the UK. And obviously that does include Scotland, Northern Ireland, Isle of Man, Channel Islands, all of whom are included under Section 66. So there's those adoptions. And then we move on to convention adoptions under the Hague Convention, overseas adoptions and foreign adoptions recognised by the law of England and Wales. And I think the difficult part of those, if you're coming new to this, is that they all sound rather similar. But in fact, they all have very different frameworks behind them.
Yes. And perhaps we'll take a closer look at each one of them, particularly the Hague Convention adoptions, which form perhaps the rump of international adoption that we'll be looking at. So in terms of the Hague Convention itself, it's a 1993 convention, and this was brought into law by the Adoption Inter-Country Aspects Act of 1999. It's the main procedural framework, which is supplemented by the Adoption and Children Act 2002 itself, and the accompanying regulations are the Adoptions with a Foreign Element Regulations 2005. And these are the adoptions, we'll call them the convention adoptions, which 106 countries are signatories to. So a large part of the work in this area is going to be concerned with these kind of adoptions.
And it's right to say there's a whole framework around convention adoptions, which is set out within the convention, as you would expect. And a key, I think, element to think about at the beginning is you do have what we call states of origin and receiving states, and they are always with respect to the child. So the state of origin will be where the child was born, and the receiving state will be the state where the child is going to be adopted. And you have to get that terminology right, or else it does cause chaos. And then equally, you have to remember that all states have a central authority. So in essence, within the convention, and you can go on the Hague Convention website and find the central authority for any given signatory. Each country will have a central authority. In the UK, it's the Department for Education, who are responsible for the day-to-day practice and regulation of convention adoptions in their country.
Yes, and each central authority will communicate with its opposite number, whether that is the central authority in the states from where the child is originating or where the child is being received. It's interesting to look at the global statistics for inter-country adoption, which countries are receiving children for adoption and how many each year, and which countries are sending the most children for adoption. The most up-to-date information is provided by the Hague Conference on Private International Law, and you can find those details on the HCCH website. The statistics have been collated for the conference by an academic, Peter Selman, covering the period 2004 to 2022, and it's based on data provided by receiving states. The number of children adopted in the UK via international adoption in 2022 is 63. Now compare that to the United States of America, which had 1,517 adoptions in 2022, and countries like Italy, which had 669, and Canada, the third most, 423. But the statistics generally appear to show a fall in numbers across all countries over time. The UK had 333 inter-country adoptions in 2004. The United States of America has figures of over 22,000 adoptions in 2004 and 2005 each. So the statistics show a decline in inter-country adoptions across all convention states over that period, which is interesting. Regarding the figures for the states of origin, so children who are leaving those states as part of an inter-country adoption, China was by some distance the highest ranked state from 2004 until 2020. From 2004 to 2006, there were over 10,000 international adoptions out of China each year. In 2022, there were 15 from China. Since 2020, Colombia is now believed to be the state sending the most children for inter-country adoption. So it's interesting to see what is happening around the world. And for practitioners here in the UK, it perhaps highlights how exacting the process is now.
And it's interesting to look at those stats over time, as you've clearly done, because you do find that they have altered over time. And it goes back to that wider policy debate around whether international adoption is a good thing or not. And it will vary from case to case, in truth. But the Hague Convention is an international convention which does endorse international adoption, albeit setting up a clear framework. And at the moment, that is the framework we work within. And so we have two types of convention adoption in essence. We have a convention adoption where the adoption actually took place abroad. That's section 66(1)(c) of the Adoption and Children Act 2002. The alternative is convention adoption order where the child is adopted in England after convention formalities in the third country. And that's pursuant to section 144 of the Adoption and Children Act 2002. And it's right to say, because it is an international convention that's been signed up to by the UK and 106 other countries, that there is automatic recognition, provided it's not manifestly contrary to public policy to recognise a convention adoption. And I'm bound to say I've never come across a case where a convention adoption has been deemed to be manifestly contrary to public policy.
Yes. Is it right, Mark, that convention adoptions ordinarily confer British citizenship?
Yes, so convention adoptions are, if you wish, some of the more straightforward types of international adoption. It is quite clear, it's section 7 of the 1999 Act, that convention adoptions do indeed confer British citizenship at the point of their being made. So that is very straightforward, in fact. So moving on, the position is that, and this is what I think a lot of people don't understand about convention adoptions, you're not, if you're trying to undertake a convention adoption with an adoption order in the UK, in fact, setting out to adopt a particular child. And that causes a lot of confusion, I think, in the common parlance of what people think about adoption, where they assume that perhaps people have gone abroad to find a child that they seek to adopt. That's not at all how it works, in fact. And under the Hague Convention 1993, the position is that unless there are certain conditions met or it's an adoption within the family, and there are specific provisions in relation to those, there isn't contact between a child and prospective adopters until, in fact, both on both sides of the equation, relevant checks and procedures have been followed. So there'll be regulatory matters undertaken in relation to the child as to whether they're suitable for adoption and whether an international adoption may represent a suitable outcome. And there are checks in the UK, in this case, upon the prospective adopters to make sure they are prospective adopters. But at that point, they will not know one another in any sense.
Yes. Yes. And there's a lot of assessment work, isn't there, between the two states, in this case, perhaps, and those who are listening who may be working in this area, the UK, the receiving state, and a state of origin. And the convention sets out a number of provisions for how the two states communicate and how the prospective adopters and the child are worked with.
There certainly are, and it's right to say Article 5 of the Convention requires quite clearly the central authority to assess the prospective adopters as eligible. In this country, as I've indicated, the central authority is the Department for Education, and there are a host of regulations under the Adoption of Foreign Element Regulation 2005 and the requirement for adoption panels to ensure that adopters are suitable persons before they can be put forward for a convention adoption. And pursuant to Article 4, in the other country, there is an assessment of the child to ensure that they are adoptable, and inter-country adoption is in the child's best interests, and that consents are given to adoption.
Yes. And the individuals who are carrying out the assessments of the eligibility and suitability of prospective adopters are defined as well. It must be a registered social worker or a social worker in training who has been given dispensation to write such a report. In the past, it seems that inappropriate individuals have been preparing these reports. So the convention is very clear that it needs to be done by a registered professional or someone who is in training to become one and has been allowed to by a manager to conduct this sort of work. And that's very important to make sure the stringency of these procedures are adhered to.
Indeed. And for those who've seen what we call Article 16 reports about the child and articles that are prepared in order to get Article 17 agreement, they are very comprehensive documents, as one would expect, I'm bound to say, yes, to make sure that all safeguarding measures are dealt with.
So on under such a report, one would be looking at the child's background, looking at their medical history, whether they have any special needs, their adoptability, looking at ethnic, cultural and religious issues as well. All of these things go into the mix in an Article 16 report. So it should be a very full picture of the child, a very full picture of the prospective adopters and their capacity to meet the child's needs as well.
Yes. And then the matching process takes place, and that is somewhat similar to the UK matching process. In essence, it's a question of finding adopters who are felt to be the best fit for relevant children. And then we reach the procedurally tricky part. And this is where it really is vital that people have an understanding of what is required of them and that the rules and regulations are followed, I think it's fair to say, to the letter to ensure that complications don't arise. So as I've indicated, of course, it is possible to have convention adoptions abroad, in which case UK adopters seeking to do that would need to comply. The difficulty and the reason that doesn't normally happen is most countries require residence before they will allow an adoption. And plainly, for most UK citizens, they're not going to go and spend a year or whatever it may be abroad in another state prior to adoption, in which case we tend to find that the matching process is undertaken and then the adopters seek to bring the children into the UK. And there are very strict rules about that, as one would expect. And so adopters must bring the child into the UK pursuant to the Adoption Foreign Element Regulations and Regulation 21 in particular. And then the adoption agency informs health, education, local authorities. And equally, there needs to be copies of reports, etc., provided. Following that, prospective adopters have to notify the local authority within 14 days of a child's arrival. And that really is quite important. If that's not done, it becomes, in essence, an illegal entry into the UK. And so there can be real procedural impacts upon that.
Yes. So the local authority must investigate and prepare a report under the Adoption of Children Act 2002, Section 44.5. And the procedure is as for domestic applications. It's very deliberately a similar similarly stringent procedure as one would have in the domestic field. So habitual residence of adopters for a year, child having been habitually resident elsewhere when Article 17 agreement has been given by the state of origin, and Home Office authorisation for the child's entry and permanent residence, if relevant.
Yes, and in terms of all of that, there needs to be that year's habitual residence, and then you'll have the end of the process, as it were, by way of the making of a convention, the convention adoption order, and the central authority sends a certificate to the central authority of the child's state of origin. So it concludes the process in their country. And it is of note, again, there's procedure, it's the President's practice guidance of December 2007 as to adoption proceedings, as to which court centre or centres can in fact hear these applications. It is of note that it is possible for a convention adoption order not to extinguish PR as usual if a convention adoption wouldn't have the status of a full adoption in the child's country of origin. So there's recognition, really, of the fact that adoption means different things in different parts of the world. We in the UK have a very firm view of adoption, which is it extinguishes PR immediately. Perhaps the world is evolving and perhaps we're more used to elements of ongoing contact. But in other countries, of course, they have a very different view of adoption and what it is. So it is possible to have a convention adoption order, but actually PR to be retained in some countries by birth parents, even though there is that convention adoption order. And I think one of the other curiosities of convention adoptions is what happens, I'm bound to say, if there's a breakdown. Again, I think people perhaps have the view that because it is a child and a set of adopters, that plainly if that place breaks down, well, presumably the child will be returned to the country of origin. That's not the case in actual fact. If adopters decide not to proceed after placement, it's entirely plausible for the adoption agency to seek to place the child elsewhere, i.e. with other people, to continue a Hague Convention adoption. And that, again, I think is perhaps not well known and might come as a surprise to some. I don't know if we want to talk about adopting a child out of the UK. I'm bound to say that doesn't happen very often.
No, perhaps not. It's perhaps worth reflecting on that briefly, particularly adopting a child out of the UK to a convention country. There are provisions in the convention for such an outcome and for preparing the child and the parents and guardians for such an application. The wishes and feelings of the child are obtained, information is provided about the adopters under the 2005 regulations. There's a requirement that there's counselling for the child and the parent or guardian, and a permanence report taking account of adoption out of the UK must be prepared in the way we've discussed for adoption in. There's an Article 16 report, and then that may lead to an Article 17 agreement between the two states, both originating and receiving. The Article 17 agreement will depend on certain matters being discussed properly within the reports, and the central authorities of both the receiving states and the adoption agency then have to work together. When one's considering removing a child from the UK, Section 84 of the Adoption and Children Act 2002 is the applicable provision, isn't it, Mark?
Yes, it is. And it's quite an unusual provision, I think it's fair to say, because obviously the standard position is that in order to have an adoption in this country, there would need to be 12 months residence before an adoption could take place. However, what we're seeking to do, or what one's seeking to do in Section 84, is the position of removing a child for the purpose of adoption to another country. And so that requires approval of the High Court. That's pursuant to Section 84 and Section 85 of the Adoption and Children Act. But the perhaps unusual nature of this is that relevant conditions have to have been complied with. So there would have to have been the Article 15 report, no immigration difficulties, Article 16 report, panel recommendation, etc. So all of that is done. But Section 84 then is a provision whereby, even though at that stage you're nowhere near an adoption, and indeed the child is being removed from the UK to have an adoption elsewhere, Section 84 in fact extinguishes PR at the point the child is removed from the country. So it's almost a precursor to adoption with a lot of the impact of adoption at that stage. It's a very unusual application. Because of that, it has unusual conditions, which in theory cause problems. And I think it's fair to say that the most commonly litigated aspect is the requirement that before Section 84 approval is granted to allow prospective adopters to remove a child from the country, they're supposed to have had the child living at home, and we'll come on to what that means, with them for 10 weeks. And Richard, I'm sure you know that that's been the subject of much litigation over the years.
Yes. So just to be clear, and it's worth bearing in mind that the power of Section 84 order, as you say, it operates to extinguish parental responsibility of all others. So that includes birth parents, it includes a local authority perhaps, which might have held a care order. So it's an extremely powerful tool indeed to operate and for a court to yield. Looking at the 10-week rule then, as you've alluded to, Mark, there's been a lot of litigation around this area and the need for the court perhaps to be flexible on how it applies the 10-week rule. What are the starting points in terms of the authorities for how the court might apply the statute?
Yes, so I think generally speaking, what the court has tried to do is enable prospective adopters where possible. And so we do have cases such as REG from 2008, which make quite clear, for example, that if it's a dual adoption, i.e. two adopters, although on the plain wording of the statute, you might think they both need to be in the UK for 10 weeks. Actually, that's not required. Actually, one of them being here, possibly a different one at different stages, would suffice. Equally, we have the courts being perhaps inventive in terms of their use of Schedule 2, Paragraph 19 of the Children Act, which is talking about pre-placement assessment outside the UK. And obviously, the rule in general is that you're not supposed to undertake assessment for adoption outside the UK. But actually, that can count as assessment towards adoption and count towards the 10 weeks. And one takes that from REMA in 2008, REA in 2009. And they are cases in support of that. And you also have the idea of a placement order being made with temporary permission to remove under ECC and SM of 2010. And as I say, those cases in general, in essence, are trying, in my view, to alleviate perhaps the strict nature of Section 84, if one reads the statute in a plain way, in effect, to make it workable and possible for prospective adopters. It does need to be stringent, care needs to be taken, but by the same token, if one believes that international adoption can be appropriate for children, one needs to facilitate it happening. So that's Section 84, and that, I think, probably brings to an end our discussion of Hague Convention adoptions. And as I say, they, in essence, were the second type of adoption that one sees. You have the adoptions within the UK, first of all, then you have convention adoptions. Then we move on to overseas adoptions, which are different from Hague Conventions, just to confuse things.
Yes, overseas adoptions will be a foreign adoption that comes within the meaning of Section 87(1) of the Adoption and Children Act 2002. So it's an adoption of a description specified in an order made by the Secretary of State, but it's not a convention adoption. It's a different class of adoption. And important to point out straight away that it's an offence under Section 83 of the Adoption and Children Act 2002 to bring in a child without assessment and cooperation with the authorities. Where adopted in a non-Hague country and a child is brought in within 12 months, the relevant regulations must still be complied with. These provisions were part of the toughening up of the law in relation to international adoption. The offence which is committed under Section 83 of the Adoption and Children Act 2002 is, on summary conviction, providing a punishment of imprisonment for up to 6 months. For conviction on indictment, so in the Crown Court, breach of this provision is punishable by imprisonment of up to 12 months. So this is, as I say, part of the international jurisprudence, and particularly the domestic jurisprudence under the Adoption and Children Act 2002, cracking down on the abusive process, which we might see with non-Hague countries.
Indeed. And the vital thing when looking at overseas adoptions, and then the last category that we'll come on to in a moment, which is foreign adoptions, which may be recognised in English law, is to look at the relevant regulations. And they are the adoption brackets, recognition of overseas adoptions orders. And they are respectively from 1973 and 1993. They updated the list. And in essence, you will fall into an overseas adoption category if the country the child is coming from is on the designated list. But one does need to check the date the child came to this country and the date the adoption took place, because the list has changed over time. And I'm about to say it's not beyond the realms that it may yet change again in future. So you do need to ensure whether your adoption is on the list of countries or not. So we have convention adoptions, if you're a convention signatory. You have adoption, overseas adoptions, in essence, whether it's in a designated list country. And then there is the final category, which is a foreign adoptions, which may be recognised at English law. So that, if you like, is the catch-all for the remainder of the world. However, you need to be very careful, because there are, in fact, pursuant to the Children Adoption Act 2006 and adoption with a foreign element, special restrictions on adoptions from abroad regulations 2008. Some countries, which the UK has decided as a matter of policy, their adoptions will not be recognised. And again, that list can and is on occasions updated. Currently, we have Cambodia, Guatemala, Nepal, Haiti, Ethiopia and Nigeria. But as I say, that list can change, does change, could change going forwards. When looking at foreign adoptions, which could be recognised if it's not a convention adoption or an overseas adoption, the question is whether that adoption order was obtained wholly lawfully in the foreign jurisdiction. So is it valid in that third country? Equally, however, does that concept of adoption substantially conform to what one might expect in the UK? And is there no public policy mitigating its recognition? And there's a real issue here, because in the UK, adoption wouldn't be recognised unless they had been domiciled for a year. The difficulty is that that rule does not necessarily apply in some foreign countries. However, if the UK is going to find that that country's arrangements substantially conform, it would expect to see a like provision, a like requirement. So in fact, it's quite difficult to have a foreign adoption that may be recognised in English law. If you are a UK citizen who has gone abroad for the purposes of adoption, because usually you'll be caught out by the domicile requirement. And there's a body of case law in relation to that, starting with Valentine Settlement in 1965, but more recently Rien in 2017 and QS and RS in 2016. And then that, I think, concludes, in essence, the four types of international adoption.
Yes, thank you very much for that, Mark. That's a nice tour through the different types. In terms of perhaps it's worth reflecting for a moment on the wider policy considerations here. There's been academic discussion as to whether or not there should be some sort of moratoria on inter-country adoption altogether. You've talked there about specific countries which the UK prescribe against adoptions being received from. And other countries, it must be said, also have their own as well. The US, for example, has moratoria on specific countries, Vietnam and Cambodia, I believe. There may be others as well. So it's still a fraught area, isn't it, globally, what is appropriate, and are the current tools at our disposal working to prevent children being trafficked or brought into the country in an unsafe way. But one, of course, has to balance that against the need for children to, if possible, enjoy the benefits of a life through adoption if it's in their best interests.
It is. That's entirely the balance to be struck. And I think the view of that balance perhaps changes over time. Even within UK adoption, as I've alluded to already, we are perhaps seeing a move towards more open types of adoption, an adoption process whereby children have more contact with birth families, more contact with their original lives, as it were. And the difficulty for international adoptions is that's actually very difficult to achieve. Because more often than not, there will be extensive travel as part of taking a child back to the country from where they were born. I appreciate the world has become smaller because of technology in some ways, but it's still difficult to communicate. And often, in the same way as one would expect in this country, if parents have either been found incapable of care or parents have decided themselves that they don't feel they can care, quite often that may be because of particular problems those parents have, which will make communications and ongoing relationships difficult. You add in the geography and it becomes increasingly difficult. And that feeds in, I think, that changing view perhaps on what adoption is for and what's right or wrong for a child in terms of developing that initial link. I think that has affected the debate and will continue to affect the debate. So perhaps watch this space.
Yes.
I think the only other thing perhaps it is worth mentioning is we've talked quite a lot about the requirements and the procedures that have to be followed. Unfortunately, case law is littered with situations where, in fact, the rules haven't been followed in the way they should have been. And unsurprisingly, those are the cases that have gone to the High Court and been reported. And it is perhaps just worth repeating and highlighting if the rules haven't been followed for whatever reason. Cases I bear in mind here are D&D foreign adoption from 2008 and Northumberland County Council and XYZ from 2009, as well as TY from 2019. There is clear authority that you have to apply to the High Court, and there's clear authority there for not actually what will be done, because every case is different at this point, but it's quite apparent that the High Court should be utilised to seek to regularise the situation. So having run through international adoption, thank you very much for tuning in to 42 Talks. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. To listen to other episodes, please follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever else you get your podcasts. Good day to you.
Goodbye.